So let's start out by just doing some mindfulness of the breathing and a brief bodhicitta motivation. Some of the sadhanas or practices that we'll do tonight have refuge in bodhicitta and the four miserables and stuff, so we'll get all of that in at some point. You know, Geshe on Sunday morning, he teaches non-round breathing, which is a nice, you know, easy way to focus the energies of the mind and settle down, or counting the breath. He emphasizes out and in as one, so up to 21. And then, if you lose your place at any point, you have to go back to round one and start all over again. So you have to have some intention to keep your mind focused as you do the breathing practice. So to practice Buddhist Tantra, you know, three things are necessary. The first is called renunciation, that it is the thought to be free of suffering and its causes, the determination to be free, and within that is at least some belief in the possibility that you could be free, that we could eliminate our suffering, or at least reduce it significantly. And also within that is a sense of a refuge, like, you know, the Buddha Dharma and the Sangha are valid objects of refuge. And probably, you know, this is not mentioned as part of renunciation, but when you talk about being totally free of suffering and achieving enlightenment, really you're talking about Tantra, the practice of Tantra. So you have to have some faith in the path to practice it. You shouldn't be taking, you know, tantric empowerment and so forth without having checked it out and checked out the teachers and all of that, and you feel confident that Buddhism is the path for you, and you want to stop your suffering, and Tantra is a valid path, and then of course the most important is your motivation for practice, which is not only renunciation, understanding of that, the basic concept of renouncing suffering and its causes, but it's also bodhicitta, this determination to be free in order to perfectly guide and serve others. So it's like, if we just want to stop our own suffering, we can jump off the train at the Nirvana station, you know? That's where our suffering stops. And it's, you know, if you achieve Nirvana, you will be so happy. I mean, people describe it as just being totally blissed out all the time. But if you want to be, if you want to actually be an amazing servant to others, if you want to be able to help other beings who are open in all conceivable ways, then the goal should be supreme enlightenment. So you shoot for supreme enlightenment. You're aiming at the top of the mountain, which is called supreme enlightenment. Why? So you can help others. That's the only reason to shoot for enlightenment, because you're blissed out when you achieve Nirvana. If all you want is your own happiness, like I said, you get off at the train at that station. But if you want supreme enlightenment for the sake of others, then you have to practice the Mahayana path, the Lam Rim, and Tantra, generation and completion stage. And then the third aspect of you know, the third prerequisite for practicing Tantra is really, really, really important, like all of it is. It's called the correct view, the correct view of reality. Wisdom. Seeing through the illusion that we create unconsciously and believe in all the time, which confuses us and causes endless suffering. And then, I've said this many times, but I'll say it again. Probably, besides understanding and having some feeling for these three principles of the path that are requisites, maybe the most important part of tantric teachings is to be able to see, you know, your subtle mind, the mind of your guru, who you see as a perfect Buddha, and the mind of the deity as inseparably one. So your subtle mind, the mind of the Guru deity as inseparably one. So as much as possible, again, the sole reason for practicing Tantra. It's said the person that has the proper motivation is someone who is impatient in the sense of being impatient with suffering and wanting to stop it as soon as possible and not wanting to wait three countless eons or how many countless eons, I'm not even sure anymore, but it's a long time. Not wanting to wait that long to become a Buddha and to stop being suffering and to be a guide, but wanting it to happen as soon as possible. And the method for doing that is the practice of Tantra. So, I must stop sentient being suffering as soon as possible. I have to find the quick path as quick as possible. My kind mother, sentient beings are dying and suffering uncontrollably around me all the time. I must develop all my qualities and eliminate my faults as soon as possible. And the method to do that is the correct practice of Tantra, which you've been introduced to by a fully qualified Vajra master. Okay, so now we have the homework questions. The homework questions. Who's ready to launch into the answers here? The first one's easy. So let's start out with the sixth one. We'll work backwards. The Mahayana path of enlightenment is said to be the union of method and wisdom. Explain how Hashyoga Tantra description of this union differs from sutra description. I have the answer sheet right here. Anybody want to take a shot at it? This is inspiring.
Primarily in the definition of method.
Isn't the difference primarily in the definition of method?
It's definitely, yeah.
In the sutra path, method refers to the development of bodhicitta and compassion.
Well, bodhicitta and compassion are part of Tantra too, so it's more than that.
Yeah.
It's, alright, so I said the Mahayana path to enlightenment is said to be the union of method and wisdom. So that's still there in Tantra. Still there in Tantra. Of course the method is, in Tantra is different. You know, compassion's still there, but it's, of course, deity yoga is a big part of it. But anybody else got a...
I'll turn the mic over to Susie.
Well, Alex Berzin, bless his heart, he gives a... You can say it, you know, he talks about it in terms of for example, method, the first... you know, the two wings of the bird's enlightenment are method and wisdom, right? And the principal method in the sutra path is, we think of it as compassion, and that's one. And the other wing is wisdom, right? So that's the bird of, that's supposed to take you to enlightenment in the sutra path. The Vajrayana path, and in the sutra path, when you, you know, when you develop compassion and wisdom, you, and this is, they make a big deal out of this, and I'm not quite sure exactly how to say more about it than just what I've heard. Just kind of be like a canned answer here, but they make a big deal out of it. The fact that method and wisdom occur sequentially. In other words, you develop, you know, compassion, and that feeds your practice of wisdom, and developing wisdom feeds your compassion. Now, how, by the way, how do you think developing wisdom would help you be more compassionate? How do you figure that? You know, having the correct view of emptiness would make you more compassionate. Why do you think that would be so? Give me an answer from over here on the right-hand side of the room. Say your name, please, so I can learn them.
My name is Rob Warren. Perhaps understanding wisdom, understanding emptiness, you sort of understand the transient nature of problems, of suffering, and
you're on the right track. Keep going.
Such that there is that you understand that there that someone who is suffering, that there is, you know, this is something that can be alleviated. You understand that it's not a permanent, like, sort of fixed condition, and that there are antidotes that you injecting yourself into the situation and with the right ways can be of assistance, can help to alleviate suffering from others. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of making you feel more empowered to engage in sort of more suffering type.
Yeah. So this professor, this guy who's a professor at UVA, he's written ever how many books, Jeffrey Hopkins, he says it this way. He says when we have some understanding of emptiness, and we see how sentient beings are, you know, project a false sense of reality, believe in it, right? And then are sucked into all these problems, anger and fear and jealousy and pride and attachment, based on these false projections that we believe in, that a Buddha or, you know, a Bodhisattva who's developing them says, a Buddha would just naturally be compassionate because that's the nature of the mind. But a Bodhisattva who's trying to train themselves more and more in that direction would see how we're all suffering literally unnecessarily. Because of our mistaken perception of reality. So it evokes compassion. So, you know, a lot of texts always start out, homage to great compassion, like that, because it's really, the heart of the path. So getting back to that, we talked about how in sutra, compassion and the practice of wisdom and method or compassion kind of aren't happening in the same moment of mind. But as Alex says, in Tantra, it all happens in one package. That wisdom and the method part of it, which is primarily deity yoga, okay? And the deity, what is the deity? You know, it's more than just, you know, a Buddha figure. Where does the deity come from? What does the deity symbolize? What is the significance of the deity? If that's a prince, you know. Now there are other, you know. Sometimes we talk about bliss, particularly in the highest yoga tantra, as the principal method too. So that's a little different conversation. But you know, in generally speaking, Alex says that, you know, the method and wisdom come together in one package, in one moment of mind. The deity, you know, when we're doing deity yoga, the really, really important meditation is when you can let go of all, you know, all these sort of ordinary conceptions about yourself. Okay, and you're living, like, I'm a man, I'm a woman, I'm old, I'm young, I'm smart, I'm not smart, but there's no way I'm gonna get, you know, I don't have the ability to get enlightened. We have this, you know, constantly have these limiting beliefs that we buy into all the time, and, that hold us back. So we have to let go of that. We have to, like, blow all that stuff, let it go completely, and meditate on emptiness and see the selflessness of oneself in all phenomena. And basically, you know, you do a dissolution process in almost every tantric sadhana. You do a dissolution process where you'll, oftentimes the guru will melt into you, right? Your guru deity will melt into your head, come to your heart. The universe will melt into your, you know, come in the light and dissolve into you, and then you'll dissolve into your, you know, the guru deity, which then becomes like the syllable hum, and it'll dissolve a little bit at a time until there's just a speck, and then it's gone. And now what you have is space. And what you're aware of is the voidness or emptiness of all phenomena. Okay, so now you're meditating on, this is called space-like meditative equipoise on emptiness. So we're really meditating on emptiness, and then motivated. Now, so here we are, motivated by this compassionate mind, because we've done some work ahead of time to generate bodhicitta. So motivated by compassion and wisdom, we cause our consciousness, which is no longer labeled Don or Ron or whoever, but it's just this consciousness that we are connected to. That consciousness manifests as the deity. And if it's Green Tara, the green lady, we manifest as Green Tara. And this whole, and it's a manifestation of compassion. Wisdom is happening right there in one package. And we're identifying with it as I am Tara. And not only are we identifying with it, we're also trying to have as clear an image of this deity as we possibly can. So it's called clear perception, or clarity is really important. But also we have this sort of dignity or divine, is called, Lama Yeshe calls it divine pride. It's where we take, you know, we think, okay, I'm a Buddha now. I am an enlightened being now, and I am Tara now. And I have these amazing potentials. I've realized them. Perfect wisdom, compassion, power, skillful means. I am that now. You know, none of this I can't do it kind of stuff that normally runs us. None of that. You know, it's any of our low self-esteem, there's no space for that as we see ourselves as this deity and constantly being aware of the emptiness of the deity. So in one moment of mind, method and wisdom come together in one package, as Alex talks about it. And that is said to be a unique feature of Tantra and one of the things that makes it so powerful. And the other thing, that when I talk about the mind that's manifesting as a deity, I'm not talking about the gross mind. This is not gross conceptual mind we're talking about. We're talking about the subtlest level of consciousness manifesting as the deity. So subtlest level of consciousness is also equated with what? Power. Subtle and power are the same thing. So we cause the subtlest level of our mind to manifest as the deity, and we're identifying with it, and we're aware of the emptiness of inherent existence all the time as we're appearing as the deity. Aware of what we're creating. So it's kind of complex, but it's very powerful. So that's the point. That's the unique feature when he's talking about the union of method and wisdom. Explain how Ashoka Tantra description of this union differs from Sutra. Okay? Yeah, Robbie said that. Thank you, Robbie. The tantric version, the cryptic version. All right, let's jump around here. Let's go to number four. The great Indian master, we're going to work the left side of the room now. The great Indian master Naropa said, if it were not for the guru, even the names of the enlightened beings would not exist. Explain this quotation in terms of the connection between deity yoga and guru yoga. Gosh, I'm glad I've got the answer sheet here. Deity yoga and guru yoga. Explained, if it weren't for the guru, the names of the enlightened beings would not even exist. The connection between deity, the practices of deity yoga and guru yoga. Not a great question either, by the way, but I'll take whatever answer you can give.
Hard to say, because what you do with the guru yoga, after all, is you visualize in his heart that you have become the same as the guru, as who is the same, who has already transformed into a deity. So I guess there can't be too much difference, can there?
But here's the answer sheet. In order to practice deity yoga, it's absolutely necessary we receive a tantric empowerment from a fully qualified tantric master. That doesn't answer the question, but that's such an empowerment is a shared meditation in which the deity, the guru, and our own mind are seen as essentially one. This is what I was talking about. But it's not our gross mind. It's really our subtle mind. The deity's mind and the guru's mind are seen as inseparably one. Okay? I know my gross mind is nowhere near like my guru's mind and what I imagine a deity's mind, but a subtlest mind is pure and untainted. Alright, also during our daily practice, we enhance our recognition of the identity between the deity and the master and our own mind through the practice of guru yoga. So, this is why every tantric practice usually has, and I alluded to this earlier, where you'll imagine that the guru comes to the crown of your head, and the guru may be in the form of Vajradhara, or may be in his ordinary form, but be, you know, basically symbolic of all the enlightened beings like that. But in any case, the guru comes to the crown of the head. If I make a mistake, I apologize, but I'm pretty sure this is right. The guru comes to the crown of the head and melts, you know, literally, you know, can sometimes just descend to your heart or meld into you, and then you see your mind and the deity's mind and your guru's mind is inseparably one, okay? And then from there, everything disappears, right? Remember we did that dissolution a moment ago? Into emptiness? And from emptiness, boom, we arise as the deity. So, this is what they said here. So he said, during our daily practice, we enhance our recognition of the identity between the deity and the master and our own mind through the practice of guru yoga. So that's there in every tantric sadhana. And it's really emphasized, I think, in this Vajrayana tradition. Therefore, it's only through the agency of such a guru that we are introduced to the Buddha. Without such a guru, the Buddha would have no meaning for us. He or she would not exist at all. So that is the answer to the question. Explain the quotation in terms of the connection between the practices of deity yoga and guru yoga. Now, I don't understand the question very well, but anyway, that's the answer. All right, now we'll jump around here to number one. Lama Yeshe gave the following descriptive names to the three principal aspects of the path to enlightenment: emerging, opening, and dissolving. List their more traditional names, define them, and briefly explain the importance of each one in providing a basis for the practice of Tantra. Susie, you're on. Pardon?
I'm not doing very well.
Okay. All right. Back here in the first row. Pardon? Come back to you. Okay, well, in the first row here. Up here in the first row. Say your name, please. Tomomi?
Yeah.
Okay. You want to take that one in?
No.
Go ahead.
No, I don't think I...
All right. Well, so how about if I said renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness? Renunciation is emerging. Sometimes it's translated as definite emergence. It's like determination to be free, to emerge from samsara. Opening is opening your heart, like bodhicitta, right? This open-hearted mind that wants to become enlightened for others. And dissolving is when we dissolve our ordinary sense of self into... because it is a fantasy, and we see ourselves as completely empty. So that's the answer. Good job. Get that. Yeah, I think that's the answer anyway. and you can't, you know, this cannot be emphasized enough that, I mean, every... is so important. I'll give you an example. Venerable Roger, Lama Zopa's attendant, and he's also the head of the FPMT and at some level. I'm not sure what he does, to be honest with you, but he's been around forever. He was the first class I ever took in Buddhism many years ago. He was like my buddy, sidekick, and turned out all these years later, he's like the big dog now, but he did a Yamantaka retreat one time, a long, you know, it's like almost it's a month or more, depending on how long you want to take to do it. But that's a highest yoga tantra retreat in New Delhi, where it is fiery hot. I mean, it is not comfortable in New Delhi. But he did this retreat there, and he told me he would do four sessions a day of this practice, you know, sometimes be, you know, hours at a time, because, you know, it's a guided meditation. You have, you know, certain guided visualizations, basically, with mantras to recite. Or, you know, there are different ones, like Omarapatsanadi is one of them that Yamantaka does. It's a mantra of Manjushri. But anyway, and most people, when they do a deity retreat, they're in a hurry to get the mantras done, you know. I got to do 100,000 of this, and I got to do 10,000 of this, and I got to go 10,000 of that one, and 100,000 of this one. So they're in a big hurry to do the mantras, and so they can say they did the retreat. But Roger said the most important thing for him, and he would sometimes spend, and I don't want to misquote him, but he would spend a lot of time doing Lam Rim meditation before if he did a 2-hour practice, he might spend an hour and a half just doing Lam Rim practice, just to get his motivation, because that's everything depends on your motivation. So much, so important that you do it with the right motive. Otherwise, the results come out bad. You know, people have done long retreats with the wrong motivation, and they waste a lot of time. So you never ever want to think of, well, there's Lam Rim and there's Tantra, and they somehow they're disconnected. They are not. And in fact, she said, or maybe I came anyway, in one of the books I was reading, said that, you know, the purpose for practicing Tantra is to develop a realization of bodhicitta and emptiness. That's the purpose of practicing Tantra, but we don't think about it. But those are the pieces that make us enlightened. Kind of interesting. All right. So if Sutra is called the causal path to enlightenment, what is Tantra called? Why? Explain the essential difference between the two approaches. Yes. And what is the essential difference between the two approaches?
Sutra, it has to do with a set of meditations.
Say it again now.
Sutra has to do with the studying a set of meditations and kind of convincing yourself that things are true. Tantra has to do with a set of practices and exercises that produce a vision of a realization of emptiness and bodhicitta as a result.
Well, I'm going to say that there was a little bit of truth in what you said, but I'm going to say it differently. Unless somebody else wants to say it. Somebody else want to say it? Get another crack at it? Did you raise your hand? All right. Say, let's hear your version of the causal path and the resultant path.
Okay, well, the common path, it's like the Buddha's over there, right? You're looking at the Buddha and you're trying to learn everything that he ever learned. And you're studying the Buddha. In the resultant path, you are studying everything. You've still done that same study, but you're also, during the sadhana and at the time you're practicing, you are actually imagining that you have become the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And eventually, maybe, as your imagination grows stronger, it will assume that that's going to happen. And I think that's the big, the difference is with the common path, it's external. And
external, what do you mean?
You're taking it in. You're saying, no, I am this.
Well, I think the easy way to, and you're saying this too, that we're in the causal path, which is the sutra path, we're trying to create the causes to become enlightened. So we're walking the path of Lam Rim, we're doing the meditations, we're doing the different, we're studying the various steps along, where you, lower scope, the middle scope, and the higher scope, renunciation, bodhicitta, emptiness, concentration, ethics, concentration, wisdom, all those things. This is basically the six perfections, right? We're trying to practice the six perfections with the hope of getting enlightened, creating all those causes. And the resultant path, we're imagining, guess what? I'm there now. All that, we're looking at three countless eons of collection of all the causes to become enlightened. And now all of a sudden we're thinking, okay, I'm enlightened now. But it's so important that emptiness yoga is part of it, isn't it? Otherwise, remember I said Darth Vader was a tantric practitioner who basically operated from an, ego. He used the powerful methods of Tantra, but he went wrong. He got the power, but it was an ego power, not a spiritual power, like a selflessness power, like a Buddha would have, for example. So, obviously, we don't know if Darth Vader practiced Tantra, but maybe, it seemed like Yoda did, but, who knows. Anyway, so... I think that's one way to think about it too. What are the advantages though of having a path that's a resultant path? What are some of the advantages? We've talked about that too a little bit. What are some of the advantages of that? Well, it is faster. Yeah. What is another advantage? Now that I wouldn't say that's implied in the resultant path, but we are definitely working with desires. We're not pushing that away. But what is the other? Help me here. What are some of the reasons that it's powerful?
Anything
Yeah, well, you mean taking in a, taking a path that's a resultant path. Why is that so helpful?
Why is the resultant path helpful?
Yeah, how is that helpful?
In terms of more helpful than...
Why is it helpful?
I
Well, the goal... Here's a couple of things. The goal seems... Right now, the goal seems pretty far away, doesn't it? But when you practice in a resultant path, it's here right now. And right now, enlightenment seems like it's like 20 countless, three countless eons seems like a long time. But if we're practicing Dhyana Yoga, it's like I'm enlightened now. So this, you know, practicing literally hopelessly. I mean, you know, we're just kind of hoping that we have a better next life. That's kind of how most of us, particularly if the sutra path is your is the main path that you practice, seems like a long time. And then another aspect of it is, and Lama Yeshe points this out, if you think you're a worthless blah, 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 you that's how we show up in the world. If we have low self-esteem, a limited view of ourselves and our potential, guess what? That becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If I'm a Buddha now, bam, there's no limitations. And Lama Yeshe says, we have such amazing potential. There's nothing we can't do. But we just sabotage ourselves. So so this is a way we can connect with our Buddha nature. Now, this is where you got to have some faith in the fact that we do have this potential. I mean, everybody would say, wouldn't you, that you have some wisdom, right? A little bit, right? Wouldn't you say you have a little bit? And a little bit of compassion, and a little bit of power, and a little bit of skillful means, and there are a lot of other qualities that a Buddha has, but these are some of the biggies. We all have some of that. It can be enhanced. It can be grown. Yes.
I just see it as giving confidence that there is an end.
Pardon?
Giving confidence.
Yeah, confidence that,
that there is an end, and if not in this life, maybe you'll get to the Tantra practice in another life, because eons, I mean, that to me is... not helpful.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so seeing it as a possibility in this life. And then this is another thing that people talk about too, is that you accumulate merit and wisdom all the time. Accumulate merit and wisdom all the time. Because 24/7, you're supposed to be seeing yourself as a deity.
Oh, if you practice.
Yeah, if you practice Tantra, 24/7, you're supposed to have method and wisdom working for you all the time, even when you're sleeping. You know, there are even practices to do while you're sleeping. So, if you see yourself as a deity and, you know, you make an offering or you hand a piece of food to an animal, but it's not just an ordinary person, you know, feeding this animal. It's a Buddha. I'm a Buddha. You know, so you're seeing yourself as an enlightened. So, in other words, you can effortlessly accumulate huge stores of merit, and merit is like the rocket fuel that gets us to enlightenment. We have to have lots and lots of merit, meritorious positive energy. So that's one way to look at that.
I have something. It sort of doesn't directly address too much, but yeah, I think it's kind of integral to the whole subject, is at the beginning of every sadhana.
Right. So hot in here.
Even during the guru yoga, essentially, you die, right? You go through all those stages.
Well, that's more to do with Hashtaga Tantra.
Fall away.
Yeah, but that's more to do with
commentary.
But taking, you know, death, rebirth, death, the bardo, and rebirth into the path and purifying those is more of a practice that's, you know, designated for Hashtaga Tantra, not so much in the lower tantras.
Well, I think it's also, though, is getting rid of that feeling of your ordinary being.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's what it has a lot to do with, is, and if you're just going into all this to do all these practices as an ordinary being, you're not going to do anything. So you have to get rid of that ordinary being at the beginning of it. And you can say it's a technique, but it's also a philosophical question for you.
Yeah.
That's, I guess, my point on it.
Yeah.
That we have to, yeah, I feel like I have to consider that.
Yeah.
I'll get there soon, pretty soon anyway, I'm sure. But
can we turn the AC down a little bit? It's just, I don't know if it's a hormonal thing or not, but I'm having hot flashes here. Okay. Causal path, deity yoga. Oh, the characteristic practice of Tantra is deity yoga. Explain the essential features of this practice, including your explanation, the meaning of the term deity and sadhana. There's two questions. The meaning of the term deity and sadhana. How this practice differs from the insane belief that one is Napoleon. See, some of this is redundant, the questions. And the way emptiness yoga is integral to deity yoga. Again, we've already answered these, haven't we? Most of them. So I'll just say this. A deity is a meditational deity. We're not talking about some, god that Buddhists worship. We're talking about a Buddha figure like Medicine Buddha and Tara and White Tara in the back and Thousand Arm Chenrezig and so on and Kala Chakra. So these are all meditational deities. These are Buddha figures that we can use, basically visualizations that eventually we can use our imagination to train our mind. It's kind of amazing. Lama Yeshe said it one time. He said, it's so cool how we can use our mind to train our mind, how we can use our mind to purify our mind. That's really cool.
Is there a Buddhist definition of deity, not just the visualization?
A Buddha figure.
It's just a Buddha figure.
These are called meditational deities. It's not a... There's a God realm in Buddhism, they call it the Deva realm, the God realm, but they're not gods like all powerful, omniscient, like the Christian, Judeo-Christian God. No, nothing like that. But they use the term deity, but it's really, Alex Berzin, he always challenges the usual translation. He says, I think it's a terrible translation. It should be Buddha figure. So go with Buddha figure. If the word, you're getting hung up on the word deity. Okay? Now, sadhana is, and these are all, I brought a whole bunch of sadhanas because I was going to give you choices tonight. Which practice do we want to do? But these are all like little meditational handbooks. Now, if you do a Hashyoga Tantra sadhana, it might be 40 pages long if it's a long version of it. Usually there's a short version, a middle-length version, and a long version of a sadhana. But some people, every day, will get up and do a long version of a sadhana. And it's a guided meditation with mantras and offerings and prayers and receiving blessings and purification. And there's different integral aspects to every sadhana to get you in a place where you can do the practice well. And I can promise you right now, people think this is empty ritual. I can tell you right now from, what I know, it is, I used to think it was too, but without the ritual part of the sadhana, you couldn't do the practice. You wouldn't have done the sort of collection of merit and the purification to get your mind in a place where you could sit still for an hour or two and do a practice. Yeah.
It took me a while to understand that this is all done in the mind. And I think the reason that sometimes I'm resistant is that my ego doesn't want to be erased, in the sense that I'm going to think my way out of that. No? Like, I'm actually more fluid and...
I don't hear the question.
I'm just trying to say, it's a comment, really. Some people are very turned off by the words deity, et cetera, and I don't know where I'm going. It's resistance. It's overcoming resistance for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the ego is going to fight. The ego, our egocentricity, which has run the show from the beginning of beginningless time until now, which is a long time, right? You want to, now is here and trace that timeline back, and it didn't just start with this lifetime, it goes on and on and on. That's been running the show. Ignorance has been running the show that long. So it's not going to give up easily. It's going to put up a fight. And so, yeah, the ego doesn't want anything that has the potential to weaken the power of it, which these practices are all aimed at doing. Are going to create some resistance.
Like, for instance, tonight I have no answers. Everything just flew out of my head.
Well, that's
fine. And I'm trying to figure out why. And I guess that's why I said this. I think that's why.
Yeah, don't worry about it. It's not, but there could be, and sometimes the figuring out the answer is the booby prize. There is no answer. It just happened. You know, that's part of our conceptual mind trying to figure things out all the time.
Yeah, I'm always trying to, yeah.
Yeah, conceptual mind. Yeah.
Doesn't any ritual have, you know, it can be a meaningless ritual. It can be the highest Buddhist ritual, right? Or it can be some, what the priest is saying in the Catholic Church every day. Now, if you understand it, you know, and think about it, that's a very different thing than just muttering off a bunch of words. Empty ritual, you can mutter the thing, you know, you can mutter the words all week. It's not going to do a whole lot. Maybe it'll set up it's not necessarily 100% negative, but it generally doesn't do too much. That's what we call empty rituals because nobody understands what it means.
So I'll answer that by one. Lama Zopa says, if you do it well. So understand what you're doing and do it well. Next question. Achieving enlightenment is said to fulfill the purpose of oneself and the purpose of others. Explain this statement in making reference to the three kayas or bodies of a Buddha. If you're in your answer, provide the names of the three kayas in either English or Sanskrit or both. I'd say both. How about in the back? In the far back, the lady who's here for the first time, can you know the answer to that? I'm just teasing. I'm a gentleman. Joe, hey Joe.
The Dharmakaya or truth body,
Yes?
The Dharmakaya or truth body, the Sambhogakaya?
Sambhogakaya.
Sambhogakaya or the enjoyment body and the Nirmanakaya or the emanation body.
All right,
were
good.
The three. And I guess when... For the purpose of oneself, I think that when we achieve wisdom and the Dharmakaya, that would be, I shouldn't say for us, but it's our enlightenment.
Mm-hmm. So that takes care of us.
Yes. And then at the same time that we receive the Dharmakaya, we also receive the Rupakaya, which is the other two.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are all of a sudden, at the same time, able to be available for the purpose of others.
Yeah, to achieve, yeah, to help the purpose of others.
They both come at the same time.
Yeah, and the Sambhogakaya is visible to who?
Higher
yeah.
beings.
Yeah, so we couldn't see a Buddha in a Sambhogakaya form. The Buddha gave these teachings in Tantra in the Sambhogakaya form. Ordinary beings couldn't see him that way. You know, like, for example, if we were an Arya being and we went to Dharamsala and saw the Dalai Lama, what we might see is thousand-armed Jinrezig. We might not see an ordinary person, right? If we were that, if we had that high realization. Or we might see him, you know, might see him in some tantric aspect.
But we do see some of the symbols from the
Sambhogakaya. Yeah, we do. And then the
which only the Arya beings can see.
Yeah, yeah. And then the Nirmanakaya form is what? That's like
ordinary beings.
Yeah, ordinary form. So that's the Dalai Lama as you and I see him, and this, you know, Lama Zopa and these other beings that are said to be, you know, enlightened, or certainly we don't know if they're enlightened, but let's just say they are. They're in an emanation body. They've emanated in a form that we can benefit from. So, yeah, good. That's an excellent answer. All right. So the homework done. Test. Everybody passed, I think. You know if you did. Anyway. So that's good. Now let's take a stretch for a few minutes, since the homework took longer to get through than I thought it would. But I think it's because I'm wordy. So we're not going to get out of here at 8:30, but I have to pick my kids up at 9, so it won't be much longer than that. So who's doing Discovering Buddhism? Who's been in it the whole time? So this is your last class. Bless your heart. And you too. Good for you. All right. Well, just do it again. But, Susie's done it 3 times. I think it's a good place to get, you know, to have discussions and stuff at this level. Oh, okay. The next round of DB, by the way, starts when? In September? Second week in September? Yeah. Okay, so we're going to do... Yeah, let's do a self-generation practice. Now, this is kind of interesting. As far as I know, there's no tantra called Shakyamuni Buddha Tantra, but in the tradition, Lamaish and Lama Zopa have put together this, you know, where you can, in other words, you're not supposed to visualize yourself as a deity unless you have taken an empowerment from a qualified tantric master. And I'm not a qualified tantric master, and you haven't taken an empowerment, so you really shouldn't see yourself as a deity. But this is the one exception. Shakyamuni Buddha practice is the one exception where you're given permission to see yourself as a deity. So what we're going to do, you know, is imagine ourselves, you know, the guru deity dissolving in, you know, in the form of Shakyamuni Buddha, dissolving into us, and then we're going to manifest as Shakyamuni Buddha and do some mantras like that. So, but I'm going to, since we're running out of time, I'm not going to through. And this is one of the reasons I'm the only person that's ever taught Discovering Buddhism, is because I'm creating the causes to go to the hell realms by cutting these sadhanas short and taking the license like that. But I think if we want to do it, I want to do one more practice. So I think this is really, I'm going to kind of cut to the chase here. Alright, so just take a moment and think about your bodhicitta motivation. You know, that wouldn't it be great? You know, you can just say, wouldn't it be great to be a Buddha? Wouldn't that just be fantastic? To be the kind of person that everybody, just being around you, lights the room up. and people just love to be in your presence and are inspired to practice the Dharma and inspired to be the best people that they can be and make good choices. And even to the point of choosing to practice Dharma and to get enlightened themselves for the sake of others. So, I mean, wouldn't that be great? And it would be. And so the quickest way to do that is practice the Dharma and particularly practice Tantra. So we're going to, do these are the prostrations that I mentioned. So Om Namo Manjushriye Namo Sushriye Namo Tamasriye. So on. By the way, there are three kinds of prostrations, right? One of them is just putting your hands here. So put your hands here, and that's a prostration. And then you can bow down, and that's another prostration. And you can do a full length prostration. So there are different versions of the prostration. Om Namo Manjushriye Namo Sushriye Namo Uttamasriye Soha. Om Namo Manjushriye Namo Sushriye Namo Uttamasriye Soha. And prostration specifically is an antidote to arrogance and pride and conceit. Big obstacles to us learning. Big obstacles. Now here's a prayer to Guru Shakyamuni Buddha, to the Guru, founder Bhagavan, Tathagata, Arhat, perfect, completed Buddha, glorious conqueror Shakyamuni Buddha, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. Please grant your blessing. So each step through here has a purpose. So now the next step is called purifying the place. Everywhere may the ground be pure, free of roughness of pebbles and so forth, may be in the nature of lapis lazuli and smooth as the palm of one's hand. Now I'm going to say a blessing offering. Some of you may know it and you can repeat it, but I'm going to say it three times. It's a little bit long. But these are Sanskrit syllables that have power. So the more faith you have in the power of the mantra, the more benefit you get. Om Namo Bhagavate Vajrasura Paramadhanaya Tathagataya Arhate Samya Sambuddhaya Tayata Om Vajravajra Mahavajra Mahateja Vajra Mahabhidya Vajra Mahabodhi Chita Vajra Mahabodhi Mando Pasam Kramana Vajrasura Karma Avarana Vishwadara Vajrasoha Om Namo Bhagavate Vajrasura Paramadhanaya Tathagataya Arhate Samya Sambuddhaya Tayata Om Vajravajra Mahavajra Mahateja Vajra Mahabhidya Vajra Mahabodhi Chita Vajra Mahabodhi Mando Pasam Kramana Vajrasura Karma Avarana Vishodana Vajrasoha Om Namo Bhagavate Vajrasura Paramadhana Yatata Gataya Ahate Samya Sambuddha Yatayata Om Vajravajra Mahavajra Mahateja Vajra Mahavijja Vajra Mahabodhi Chira Vajra Mahabodhi Mando Pasam Kuramana Vajrasura Karma Avarana Vishodana Vajrasoha. Alright, so that's multiplying the blessings of the practice. By the power, now this is called the power of the truth, by the power of the truth of the three jewels, of the blessings of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and the power of the great might of the completed two collections, and the completely pure, inconceivable sphere of reality, may all these offerings become just so. Now, this part I'm gonna abbreviate because it's a little bit long, but it's the visualization of Shakyamuni Buddha. So, I thought I turned this thing off. Sorry. Okay, so what we're going to do is visualize Shakyamuni Buddha, and what you need to know is that now you can. Has anybody ever seen a hologram? Has everybody seen a hologram? Yeah. This is not a hologram, but it's like a hologram. It's like at the level of your forehead. And 2 meters in front of you, you're going to visualize a throne supported by snow lions. Okay? completely made of light, like a hologram. But you're visualizing this in your mind's eye. Now, what does it mean to visualize in your mind's eye? If I said visualize your car, instantly you could see it, couldn't you? So, in your mind's eye, I want you to see this throne, this beautiful, you know, golden, precious stones, in, you know, completely made of light. And it's real. It's just as real as you and I. But it's made of light, and it's in the space in front of us, a body, you know, like 2 meters in front. And on the throne is a lotus, this giant lotus, and on that, a sun and a moon seat. Okay? Maybe it's a moon and a sun seat. Yeah, a sun and a moon seat. And on top of that is seated Shakyamuni Buddha in the same form as is behind me. Okay? In this, you know, the golden, the image of the Buddha. Okay? And but I want you to think that we're not sitting in front of a hologram, even though his body is completely made of light. But I want you to feel as if we're in the living presence of the Buddha. Like he is really here. This is a living presence, not just some game we're playing with our mind. I mean, it's said a Buddha's consciousness pervades every atom of the universe, right? So the Buddha's consciousness is here. We're just giving it a form. So now we're in the living, imagine, you're in the living presence of the Buddha. And his right hand is in the earth-touching mudra, and he's touching the moon disk, and his left hand is in his lap, and he's holding a begging bowl filled with nectar, and his eyes are like half open and half closed. He's got long earlobes, and his face is so beautiful. His body is perfectly healthy, and you know, shimmering in every aspect. He has the golden robes of a yellow robes of a monk. He has blue-black hair as a top knot, and each hair is curled in a certain way, and he has a little curl right in the center of his head. Every aspect of his being has profound symbolic meaning. Profound symbolic meaning. Here we are in the presence, in the living presence of a Buddha. And he's smiling at you, and his compassionate gaze is directed at you and at all living beings at the same time that are surrounding you. Imagine that your mom and dad, mom's on left, dad's on right, you're surrounded by all living beings. And the Buddha, his smiling, compassionate gaze is directed at you and all living beings. And he only exists for one reason, and that's to help. That's his only purpose, is to help. And then we talked about refuge a little bit, so I'm going to do a Sanskrit, and some of you know this. Well, you know, we can do it, but it's, you know, remember the reason for taking refuge. Those of you who have been discovering Buddhism, there's three motivations for taking refuge. One is fear, or dread, or just, you know, just this sort of feeling of, oh my God, with the kind of mind I have living in this world where, you know, what do I have to look forward to? Sickness, old age, and death? With this kind of mind, I'm going to suffer, you know, and problems are queuing up. Problems are just queuing up. And I don't have it, I'm not together enough to handle what life's got to serve me and do it with a calm and peaceful and joyful mind. And I think it's possible to do that. Wouldn't that be great to be able to deal with every aspect of your life from now until you take your last breath and to do it with dignity and with awareness and joy and a sense of freedom? Wouldn't that be great? But we realize we don't have that. We dread living life with the kind of mind we have. So we go to refuge. We entrust the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha because they can help us. Okay? So that's the one of the motivations. And the other one is confidence. We have confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. We practice this path. We've seen our mind shift. We have some confidence that this is a valid path for us. Okay? And then compassion for ourselves, of course, which is the same thing as renunciation, and for all beings. We want to practice a path that's going to help us solve our problems and help others solve theirs. So those are the motivations for taking refuge. So the mantra for taking refuge is, and we're going to do the Sanskrit one, it's Namo Gurubye, Namo, I'm going to say it 7 times. And then Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, and Namo Sanghaya. So the first one means I go for refuge to the Guru, the second one to the Buddha, the third one to the Dharma, and the fourth one to the Sangha. Namo Gurubye, Namo Gurubye, Namo Gurubye, Namo Gurubye, Namo Gurubye, Namo Gurubye, Namo Gurubye. Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya. Namo Dhammaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Dhammaya. Namo Sanghaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Sanghaya, Ya Namo Sanghaya. And if there's an elaborate visualization where as you say this light and nectar from Shakyamuni Buddha, fills your body and completely purifies you of all your negativities and grants you blessings. And in the bodhicitta motivation, we've already talked about that. I'm not going to go into that. And then there's the 4 measurable thoughts. And remember what those are. There's immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable joy, and immeasurable equanimity. Those are called the 4 immeasurables. So may all beings have happiness, and the causes of happiness is love. May all beings be free from suffering, and the causes of suffering is compassion. May all beings never be separated from the happiness that is untainted, and that's joy. And then may all beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for some and hatred for others. So that's equanimity. Okay? So again, we're laying the groundwork for the actual practice. And then special bodhicitta, in particular, I must achieve enlightenment quickly in order to free all the numberless kind mother sentient beings from the unimaginable ocean of samsaric suffering and causes of suffering and lead them to the peerless enlightenment. For this purpose, I'm going to meditate on the stages of the path. And in the 7-limb prayer, we're not going to do that tonight because we don't have time. And the mandala offering, we can do that one, and I'll read it out. Well, I'll say the 7-limb prayer. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. Remember, that's paying homage. I present every cloud. I present clouds of every type of offering, actually offered and mentally transformed. I confess all my negative actions accumulated during beginningless lifetimes and rejoice in the virtues of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until samsara ends and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. And in the mandala offering, again, you're imagining that you're offering a universe of all kinds of wonderful things to the enlightened beings to be able to do this practice. So this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, 4 continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. And then I go for refuge. This is a prayer for 3 great purposes. I go for refuge to the Guru, the 3 precious sublime jewels. Please bless my mental continuum. Please bless me and all sentient beings to cease immediately all wrong conceptions from incorrect devotion to the Guru up to the subtle dual view of white appearance and red increase in black near attainment. Please bless me and all sentient beings to actualize immediately all the correct realizations from guru devotion up to the unification of no more learning and to pacify immediately all outer and inner obstacles. Idam guru radnamandala kamneyatayami. Now, I'm going to cut to the chase here in just a moment. So here's a request. Again, these are all integral parts of any tantric sadhana. So now we're requesting Guru Vajradhara, who encompasses the Vajradhara is like symbolic of all the enlightened beings. It's a Buddha. The Buddha in tantric aspect. Guru Vajradhara, who encompasses all three objects of refuge, taking the form of the virtuous friend, so that's the guru, in whatever way subdues and granting common and sublime realizations, to you kind gurus I make request, whose holy body is created by millions of virtues and goodness, whose holy speech fulfills the wishes of all sentient beings, whose holy mind sees every existence exactly at the holy feet of the principle of the Sakyas, I make request. By making offerings and requests with devotion to the highest sublime field of merit, you, the Savior, who are the sole source of all my happiness and goodness, please grant me blessings and guide me with your blessed holy mind. And now would be the graduate. Sometimes in this particular text that Lama Zopa created, it was the foundation of all good qualities, but we've covered most of those points and we're not going to do that tonight. Now, here's where we request the guru to descend to the crown. So Shakyamuni Buddha is like the guru deity, okay? So we're asking him to descend to the crown. So glorious and precious root guru, please abide at the lotus and moon seed on my crown, and taking care of me with your great kindness, bestow upon me the attainments of your holy body, speech, and mind. Now, so what's going to happen here is Shakyamuni Buddha, this living presence, that's the embodiment of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and the Guru, okay? The four objects of refuge that we talked about, you know, the guru, taking refuge in the Guru, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. His embodiment of all of that comes to the crown of our head and is like facing in the same direction as we are. As you recite Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra, which is this one up here, we'll start out visualizing that light and nectar beams, white in color, flow from Shakyamuni Buddha's heart. They enter your body, speech, and mind, and purify all diseases, spirit harms, and negative karmas and obscurations. All negativities are washed out of you just as dirt leaves clothes when you wash them. So I'm going to say this mantra out loud, and then you can, if you have memorized it, it's very easy to memorize it, but we'll say it out loud, and then I'll say it quietly, and we'll just do it for a minute. But importantly, you want to see that this white nectar is coming from the heart of Shakyamuni Buddha, who's the embodiment of our Guru and the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, right? And is completely washing us free of all negativities. So the mantra is just repeated after me. You may not have heard it. It's Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muniye Soha Taya ta om mune mune maha muniye soha. 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 Now you can say the mantra silently, or you can say it under your breath. But not, we've already done the loud part. So you want to say it. Usually when you say mantras in a retreat, you kind of say it so that the person next to you couldn't hear you, but you know you're saying the words. So for me, you know, I've got the microphone, and it's a bit like, Taya ta om mune mune maha muniye soha. All the time thinking in my mind, you know, is being purified by this light and nectar coming down from the Guru deity. Now we're going to continue reciting the mantra, and now we're visualizing yellow light and nectar flowing from Guru Shakyamuni Buddha's heart and entering your body, speech, and mind. With this light and nectar, you receive all the qualities of the Buddha's holy body, speech, and mind. Concentrate that your mind has been transformed into the perfect understanding of Buddha's omniscient mind, and that you have obtained Buddha's perfect compassion and perfect power. You become a perfect guide and able to fulfill the wishes of all beings and to bring them every happiness, especially the highest happiness of enlightenment. Generate a strong wish and determination to free every being from suffering and its causes. Feel determined that you'll live your life in this way with the good heart, feeling great compassion and loving kindness for all sentient beings, and being committed to freeing them from all suffering and the causes of suffering, and bringing them to the state of full enlightenment. Imagine that because you've generated this thought to benefit all beings, the good heart, and because you're making your life worthwhile, the Buddha is extremely pleased with you. So, say mantra again, and this time the light and nectar is bestowed on all these qualities and realizations of the Buddha, and the Buddha is really happy with us. Dayata om mani mani maha mani yaso. Dayata om mani mani maha mani yaso. Dayata om mani mani maha mani yaso. Delighted. Now, visualize that Shakyamuni sends a light, and this light absorbs into you. And that your body, speech, and mind become oneness with Guru Shakyamuni, Shakyamuni Buddha's body, speech, and mind. Now that's different than seeing yourself as the Buddha. Okay? And now imagine that your body, you know, first of all, that the entire universe absorbs into your body, so there's nothing outside you. And your body absorbs, you know, absorbs to your heart, gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. It's like a little point, and then disappears. So your body completely disappears. And so what appears to your mind is space, and what you're aware of is emptiness, and what you're motivated by is compassion. And this is your subtlest mind. And from that space of emptiness, suddenly you arise as the Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. You know, this golden body wearing yellow robes of a monk, beautiful smiling face, looking at all beings, perfect wisdom, perfect compassion, power, and skillful means. And as much as possible, you know, you're in an earth-touching mudra, you're sitting on the throne with the lotus sun and moon seat, and your body's completely made of light. It's not a heavy, gross body, completely made of light. And you have perfected every quality. You are an enlightened being now. And think, I, and now you're labeling I, not on your ordinary I, but on this Buddha I, this Buddha figure called Shakyamuni Buddha. I am Buddha now. I have achieved all of the perfect qualities of enlightenment. And generate this divine dignity, divine pride in being Buddha. You know, we're just connecting with our Buddha nature. We have this potential. We're just acknowledging it and connecting to it and identifying with that instead of our limitations. From the pores of your body, which is now in the aspect of Shakyamuni Buddha, light beams are emitted toward all sentient beings in all directions. The negative karmas and obscurations of body, speech, and mind of all sentient beings are completely purified. And every sentient being becomes Buddha. Yeah, so you could spend a lot of time with these visualizations, but you might even just take one or two people that you're close to and imagine that the light goes into, you know, maybe somebody that you know, a family member or a friend, or you can just take the general, you know, all sentient beings. But to make it really real for you, sometimes it's helpful just to see like a friend who's suffering and think that all of their obstacles are purified. The light and nectar from your heart and from the pores of your body purify all their negativities, develop all their qualities. They take an interest in the Dharma, they practice it, and they achieve supreme enlightenment. All based on what you have, you know, what you've generated, what you've caused by your enlightened presence. In this way, every being that appears to you appears as a Buddha, and every place that appears to you as a pure place. Rejoice by thinking how wonderful it is that I have enlightened all sentient beings. Here we're taking the future result. How wonderful it is that I've enlightened all sentient beings. I'm a Buddha, and I've enlightened all sentient beings. And now there's dedication verses as a result. And this will be the dedication because it's now... This will be the dedication for the class. So this is also a way of a couple of pages. But it's, you know, thank you for your attention. This is, I like to teach this class. And I always learn a lot. And I appreciate that people show up so I get a chance to teach it. Otherwise, I'd be here all alone. As a result of my own merits of the three times, and I want you to think about, you know, you can, maybe we'll do that other dedication too, but I want to read Lama Zopa's dedication. As a result of my own merits of the three times and the merits of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and sentient beings, may the altruistic wish to achieve enlightenment be generated in my mind and in the minds of all sentient beings without even a second's delay. And may that altruistic wish that has already been generated be increased. Whatever suffering sentient beings experience, may it ripen on me, and whatever merit and the resulting happiness I have accumulated, may it ripen on others. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and goodness, all-powerful Tenrezig Tenzin Gyatso. That's His Holiness, His long life prayer. Equaling the extent of space of happiness, may I and others without exception accumulate merit and purify negativities, and may we be blessed to quickly attain Buddhahood. Due to the merits of the three times created by me and by others, and by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, may we be able to meet perfectly qualified Mahayana virtuous friends in all of our future lives. From our side, may we always see them as enlightened. May we always perform only actions most pleasing to the holy mind of the virtuous friend. And may we always be able to fulfill their holy wishes immediately. So this is referencing the importance of the qualified teacher. So rare to find one. Because of these merits, may my actions never cause even the slightest harm to any sentient being. Instead, may they bring only the greatest benefit. Whatever suffering or happy life I experience, may it be only of the greatest benefit to others, causing them to achieve enlightenment as quickly as possible. Due to all the merits of the three times accumulated by me and others, merely by seeing, hearing, remembering, touching, or talking to me, may any being be freed in that very second from all their sufferings, diseases, spirit harms, negative karmas, and obscurations, and abide in the peerless happiness of full enlightenment. Wouldn't it be great to be that kind of person? Just hanging around you makes other people pure and want to practice. I can't answer that. I'll call him later. Due to the merits of the... Like Lama Tsongkhapa, may I be able to offer extensive benefits equaling the limitless sky to all the sentient beings and the teachings of the Buddha from now on and in all future lives. By having all the qualities of Lama Tsongkhapa within me. So in the Gelug tradition, Lama Tsongkhapa is sort of like... He's a Buddha. He's an enlightened being, and he's kind of there are four traditions of Tibetan Buddhism, but he was the principal, the person who really started the Gelug tradition that we practice in. Just as the brave Manjushri and Sumantrabhadra, these are Buddha figures, realize things as they are and dedicated all their virtues in the best way, may I follow after them. Whatever dedication the virtuous one, the virtuous one's gone to bliss of the three times have admired as best, I shall also perfectly dedicate in the same way all the roots of virtue so that I may perform good works. Due to the merits which are empty from there, this is Lama Zopa's special dedication, so this is an emptiness dedication. Due to the merits which are empty from their own side, accumulated over three times by me and the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, may I, who am empty from my own side, achieve the state of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment, which is empty from its own side, and lead all sentient beings, who are empty from their own side, to the state as quickly as possible by myself alone. Because of the past, present, and future merit created by me and by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and sentient beings, may I, my family, disciples, and all sentient beings be able to actualize completely in this very lifetime Lama Tsongkhapa's path of unified sutra and tantra, which is pure like refined gold. And may these pure teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa spread in all directions and flourish forever. Because of all the merits of the three times created by me and all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and other sentient beings, may there be no wars, famines, diseases, quarreling, fighting, or unhappy minds. May there be great prosperity, and may everything needed be easily obtained. May all human beings in the world be guided by spiritual leaders teaching only Dharma, and may everyone enjoy the happiness of the Dharma. May everyone have perfect conditions and have only compassion and love for each other in their mind streams. And may they only benefit and never harm each other. May I and all... So let's read the dedication verses out of the book. So, may all beings... You got that one? May all beings everywhere, plagued by the sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merit. May no living creatures suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with the mind weighed down by